You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning, I'm Joy Cardine. It's 10 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Friday, April the 6th, and this is our Friday Week in Review. Today we have two guests with us with unique and differing perspectives on the top news stories of the week, and we will welcome your calls on the issues and developments this week that you would like to talk about internationally, nationally, and right here in the state of Wisconsin. And let's proceed in that order. We'll start internationally and talk some about the release this week of the British sailors and Marines by Iran. One of our guests this week knows what it's like to be held hostage in Iran. We will spend the second segment of the program talking about mainly national politics, including the latest salvos in the debate between the president and Congress over the spending bill that provides funding for the war in Iraq, but also contains a troop withdrawal deadline. And then we'll spend the last third of the program or so talking about state issues in the news, including the results this week of the election, the state Supreme Court race. One of our guests has been following this race, and we will talk about why we got the outcome we got. Washington County Judge Annette Ziegler was elected to a 10-year term on the court this week by rather soundly defeating Madison attorney Linda Clifford. And we will fit in your comments on the issues in the news this week as well, your questions for our guests, the issues you want to talk about, 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, in Madison, 263-1890, or send your topic to talk at WPR.org. Please include your first name and your community with your email. Joining us now for this week's Week in Review, Kevin Hermaning, former chair of the Marathon County Republican Party. He was one of the Americans held hostage in Iran during the Iranian hostage crisis, and he is currently a financial planner in Wausau. Good morning.
Good morning, and thank you for the invitation this week.
Yeah, thanks for being with us. Also with us is Bill Leaders, news editor of Isthmus, Madison's Alternative Weekly. He is also president of the Wisconsin Freedom of Information Council and author of the book Cry Rape. Good morning.
Good morning. Now out in paperback.
That's right. It's brand new in paperback. Well, let's start with, as I mentioned, the international scene and talk about the release this week of the captives, the British sailors and Marines who were being held captive in Iran for about 2 weeks because they allegedly sailed into Iranian waters. The president of Iran, Ahmadinejad, says that this was a gift to the people of Britain. What do you make of that gift, Kevin Hermaning?
Well, they always say you shouldn't look a gift horse in the mouth, and this is a Trojan horse. And I guess from my perspective, it's just more of the same. A lot of people have criticized the president, our president, for using the phrase axis of evil and have suggested if only we would be nice, the special counsel appointed by the president of the bipartisan commission on how we should deal with the problems of the Middle East came out and said if only we would diplomatically try to deal with the Iranians, we could, and other folks like them, we could get them to sit down and we could trust them and it would all be agreeable. I just don't think that the regime is quite yet ready to enter the community of nations.
Yeah. Well, why do you call it a Trojan gift horse?
Well, because this wasn't about the hostages. This wasn't about the British troops going allegedly into Iranian waters. This was all about propping up the price of oil and feeding the coffers of the regime in Iran. It was all about the Iranian clerics trying to hold on to their power despite massive riots among farmers, among teachers, among union workers and students in the country trying to overthrow their government and bring about freedom of opportunity and prosperity back to their country like it used to be. The problem there is that there are 20 million Iranians who have been held hostage by the regime for the last 25 years or so. It's only about 5, 6, 7% of the populace there that actually supports the way that they're running their country right now.
Yeah. Your thoughts, Bill Leaders, on this?
Well, let me stipulate that unlike Kevin, I've never been held hostage. A couple of movies I've been to, I really wanted to leave and wasn't able to, but that's about as bad as my experience has gotten. I don't know, though, why you look at this situation and see it as a failure of diplomacy. It seems like it's a success of diplomacy. Britain did not overreact. It did talk to Iran after this incident came to light, and through communication and by staying calm, it was able to get a good resolution to this crisis. And I think it shows that Iraq is a country that can be talked to, that there are enough internal political divisions in that country that pragmatism will prevail if there is an option for it to prevail.
Well,
and
Bill,
diplomacy,
I think that
is a way of delivering that.
Bill, I just think that the Iranians realize that the British captives lost their usefulness for the regime during the last 13 days. They finally accomplished everything that they felt they could. We had the third U.S. naval carrier group, the USS Nimitz, steaming to the Persian Gulf, 3-4 days away from arrival, and I just think that they were unwilling to face whatever potential consequences may have resulted beyond potentially a failed effort in diplomacy. You're right. This was a diplomatic resolution to what could have become a very difficult crisis. But once again, I think everybody observing this has to realize that Iran got away with capturing people with impunity, capturing and holding people. There has never, ever been any blood or treasure extracted from the Iranians for their state sponsoring of terrorism.
Let me go to Chris in Milwaukee. Oops. Well, there we go. We have a problem with our phones right away. Let me see if I can fix this. Let's go to Steve in Oshkosh. Hi, Steve.
Yes,
you're on the air. Steve, are you there?
Yeah, I am.
Go ahead, please.
Okay. I'd like to ask the guests, if you were a citizen of the world, say you're in Brazil or in Canada, after the pictures this week, would you prefer to be detained by Iranians in Iran with nice suits and being well-fed and well-treated, or would you prefer to be held by the Americans in light of the Abu Ghraib photos and Guantanamo jumpsuits and indefinite detention?
I'm sorry, was that addressed to Kevin Hermaning?
Yes, I thought the theater of it all and the way it played out in public perception showed, again, how much smarter and more adept President Ahmadinejad is than our bumbling guys in the White House.
Kevin Hermaning?
Well, I just think it's an absurd comparison. The 14 men and one woman who were captured from their boat in the Persian Gulf were not engaging in terrorist acts and were not ever expected, or nobody was accusing them of potentially blowing up buildings or fomenting military actions or non-military actions, nonetheless, but violent means to accomplish their goals.
Yeah, let me switch subjects here. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi went to Syria, was criticized by President Bush this week for this visit. She is hoping for a breakthrough in U.S.-Syria relations. He says she is encouraging a state that sponsors terror. Any thoughts on who's right here, Bill Leaders?
Well, you know, Bush and his spokespeople keep using the same word to describe Pelosi's visit to Syria. They say it's counterproductive. And I agree. Bush, in ignoring the recommendations of the Iran study group, which was backed by James Baker, which urged the United States to talk to Syria, in refusing to do that, Bush has made absolutely no progress. And what Pelosi is doing threatens to run counter to that.
Kevin Hermaning?
Well, The reason that it's counterproductive is that her proposals, her recommendations and suggestions run counter to U.S. foreign policy. Besides the fact that she is not responsible for foreign policy, she is the Speaker of the House, which gives legitimacy to anything that she states on behalf of the entire country, which it doesn't merit. She is only the Speaker of the House. She is not the Secretary of State. She is not the President of the United States. And yet, by the same token, she is the Speaker of the House, which means she's just not some two-bit congressperson from another state or even her own state who doesn't have the same credentials as leader of the parliamentary body of our country. And that, unfortunately, gives whatever she says a higher degree of importance though it isn't warranted. And it is very, it's not just counterproductive, I think it's dangerous.
Well, don't you think other people can make the same distinction that you make, that she isn't the president, she isn't the Secretary of State, she's just the Speaker of the House, and she is there as the Speaker of the House, representing her own position, and I don't know that it is. She is saying something that runs counter to foreign policy to the extent, except to the extent that the Bush policy is not to talk to people it doesn't like whatsoever, and she's willing to talk. I understand that she did press Syrian officials on concerns that the United States has, and in that respect was on the team in terms of advancing the concerns of the U.S. And what she did is hardly unprecedented. This big hubbub over it, you know, is like she's done something that no member of Congress has ever done before. Members of Congress have regularly had their own intrusion into foreign policy concerns. When before Denny Hassert became Speaker and Clinton was president, he went to Colombia and tried to negotiate some things with regard to drug trafficking in contravention of the Clinton administration's agenda.
He wasn't Speaker of the House, though, as Bill, is the point.
He wasn't. I said before he was. But, you know, it's not unprecedented that members of Congress do take initiatives like this, and I don't know that it's manifestly irresponsible or that it created any ill consequence for the United States.
We also have former attorneys general who have traveled around the world defending and propping up regimes, and you're right, we've had members of Congress, but not speakers of the House, who have traveled to other parts of the world. Back in the 1980s, members of Congress were traveling down and embracing Danny Ortega in direct counter to what the goals and the objectives of our government really were and are. And probably, in my view, should have been.
We're going to talk more after we take this short pause, shifting into some national issues, including the feud between Congress and the president over this supplemental war spending bill. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. This is the Friday Week in Review. Our guests today, Kevin Hermaning, former chair of the Marathon County Republican Party. Also with us, Bill Leaders, news editor of Isthmus, Madison's Alternative Weekly. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. Good to have you with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. Coming up, it's Ben Marins this afternoon between 4 and 6 at Issue with Ben Marins. And after 4, as usually on Friday, it's your views on the news, talking more about those British sailors being released, the millions of dollars that are being poured into the presidential race, and other top stories of the week. That's coming up after 4. Well, we'll be talking about some of those issues as well as we go on in our Friday Week in Review with our two Week in Reviewers, Bill Leaders and Kevin Hermaning. Let's talk about President Bush blasting Congress this week, held a news conference in the Rose Garden, said Congress was playing politics, was being irresponsible for this bill that hasn't entirely been resolved yet, that provides funding for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. It's a supplemental spending bill that also contains a lot of pork, like spinach subsidies, and it also contains a deadline for withdrawing troops from Iraq. And the president says he's going to veto it, and Congress needs to send it to him so he can veto it, so we can get on to the business of funding this war. What do you make of this, Kevin Hermaning?
Well, it's the Democrats playing politics at home, as the national news has talked about, has indicated. President Bush clearly believes, as he said in the Rose Garden, that this isn't about providing the troops with the dollars that they need. It's been nearly two full months since he requested the $100 billion to spend in Iraq and to not only support our troops, but also to advance the effort that the president is seeking to accomplish there, and that's to bring about a democratic government that is stable. And the Congress has not yet acted.
Now, what do you think, Bill Leaders?
Well, Congress did pass the additional war appropriation funding. I wish that it hadn't, but the both houses of Congress did approve more than $100 billion to keep this war going. All they did is attach some non-binding language that would set an endpoint to our involvement in Iraq. And the president is so against that notion that he's willing to veto the entire spending appropriation. That's on him.
It's well, wait a minute. I thought we were going to have, when we had the new Congress, I thought we were going to strip all of the non-relevant issues from particular pieces of legislation. They hang all this stuff on, they hang all these non-relevant items.
You mean all the pork that's attached to that?
All the pork plan? and the fact that there is a timetable for withdrawal attached to a spending bill. It's not relevant. It's not part of the same process.
Well, I agree the pork shouldn't be there. I don't know that it's not relevant that Congress, in its role as overseer of war appropriations, should ask for an endpoint to our involvement, since that's clearly what the American people want.
Yeah, let me get a caller in on this topic. Dave in Wanakee, hi, you're on the air.
Yes, hello. I think it's kind of interesting. At the beginning of the war, Democrats were in a bind. They could, oppose the war and lose their swing votes, or they could support the war and lose their base, and now Republicans are in that bind. They can support the president and the escalation, and they'll lose the swing votes, or they can support the Democrats and the end to the occupation, and they'll lose their base.
Kevin Herman, you want to react to that?
I think it's ludicrous to suggest that this is about supporting the president's position. This is about making a decision as to whether you support the interests of the United States government abroad in a very dangerous part of the world, in a very economically important part of the world. What are we going to do when it comes to trying to get resolution in a peaceful manner? Let's take this beyond just the Iraq vote. Let's take this beyond support for the troops in Iraq. Everybody's calling for a renewal of the peace talks between Israel and the Palestinians again. It seems that people only want to be internationalists when it suits their purposes, rather than either believing that at their core or dispensing of that notion at their core. You cannot make a decision only sometimes to have that kind of policy. That's one of the reasons that Pat Buchanan never went any place. He selectively chose when he wanted to get involved internationally, and then other cases, and by and large, he was always opposed to internationalism on the part of the U.S. government, but he wanted to selectively choose a couple of battles. That's what some of the Democrats are trying to do now.
I guess I don't accept that premise there, Kevin, that first of all, that going to war against Iraq on false pretenses and then having a continued open-ended involvement in that nation's civil war does serve the interests of the United States. I think it runs counter to the interests of the United States. It runs counter to what the American people want to see happen, and the sooner we get out of that hellhole, the better.
Let me take one more call on this topic. Carolyn in Green Bay. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I think if Congress gives him a spending bill for the war and he vetoes it, most Americans are going to hold him as being responsible for holding up the funding. And I'm wondering why I've not heard any mention of a what I believe is a questionable tactic that Bush has used hundreds of times in the first 6 years, and that is to sign the legislation and issue one of his dubious signing statements, which says, I'm only going to follow the part of this law that I think is correct. Maybe it's because most Americans are unaware that this has been going on, and I think it's a really questionable, unethical tactic on his part.
Well, might he do that, Bill Leaders? He says he's going to veto this bill, but maybe he should just sign it and say, but I'm not going to withdraw any troops.
I think he can do that. Mm. I think the language in the bill itself is not binding. It does not require that he withdraw at that timetable. I wish it did. I wish it was binding. I wish Congress would back it up with stronger measures to extricate the United States from this quagmire. But I think that's an option.
Yeah, if it's not binding, Kevin Hermaning, what's the big deal of the president signing this?
Because he doesn't believe that there should be a timetable for withdrawal of the troops. By signing the legislation, it suggests that he's in agreement with it. That's the reason he wouldn't sign it.
Why can't he sign it and say, I disagree with that part of it?
Because it's part... It just doesn't make sense. It sends the wrong message to the people we're trying to fight with over in Iraq, as well as our future enemies who are watching what's going on in Congress right now, as well as with the White House. I want to, Bill, if just for a second, if we could go back to what you said about, you know, it would run counter to our, it runs counter to our interest to stay there in Iraq. You and our other, some of our listeners actually already mentioned in their calls this morning that we are occupiers there. Are we occupiers in your sense of the word because we still have a force there? Because we still have a military presence that is quite substantial in Japan and in Korea and in Germany. Here we've only been in Iraq for about 4.5 years or so, and it seems to me, or less than that actually, but it seems to me that what we ought to be doing is securing the area and putting that part of the world in a position so that they don't, that there will not run counter to the objectives of our country, of the national security of the United States. National security also involves economic security and a whole host of other items.
I think our presence in Iraq is characteristically different from being in Japan or Germany. For one thing, in Japan and Germany, people aren't killing our soldiers at the rate of, you know, 3,200 over the last 4 years.
No, I guess the tens of thousands who did die earlier was much better way to have it happen. Is that what you're saying?
You mean back when,
during
when
the
Saddam
World
Hussein
War
was our friend and we were arming him and supporting him and he was killing his people? Is that the time you're referring to?
The enemy of my enemy is my friend is what they always say when it comes to the Middle East. And so the United States government back in the 1980s, Oliver North and President Reagan were supporting the Ayatollahs in their Iran war. It's just one of those things that is very complicated. But what I'm trying to get at is, if you're so passionate about bringing the troops home, why aren't you passionate about bringing the troops home from Germany or from Korea or from the Panama Canal or any of the other places abroad that our troops, is it just because they're being shot at? We're in the middle of a war. Of course they're being shot at. What you ought to be doing is encouraging the president to force his generals and not the politicians in the White House and in Congress to be battling the war really through the news media and encouraging him to let his generals run the war.
I would do that. The president very rarely returns my phone calls.
Exactly. You're just missing the whole point, or you're refusing to answer it because you don't have a good argument.
Well,
I think I do.
I think most people would agree with me that our involvement in the Iraq War was not a smart thing to do. It's not advancing our interest as a nation, either in terms of our international image or in terms of our current national security objectives.
What about our economic security issues?
What, that our access to oil? Is that what you're
referring
to?
Precisely. Exactly right. Go
well,
ahead.
Well, you know, I talked to a conservative before the war started. It was actually someone who's on the show quite often, John Sharpless.
Yep.
Who said that, you know, that was truly a major reason for our involvement in that conflict in that region.
It still is.
Have access to oil. And I guess I wish that people weren't killed over preserving our access to oil. I guess that wouldn't be a main objective of our foreign policy, to ensure the access of oil companies to oil supplies to fuel our addiction to foreign oil. I think
it's not just for the United States, it's for all of the free world upon which the U.S. depends.
Yeah.
Well,
we need to
move on. God bless America and the oil companies.
We need to move on to some other issues here. There's also lots of news this week about the amount of money being raised by the 2008 presidential candidates. Hillary Clinton on the Democratic side raising a record-breaking $26 million in the first quarter of the year. And then, we didn't know right away, but Barack Obama, a couple of days later, released his fundraising total, and he raised $25 million. So pretty close between Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, with lots and lots of money being raised. What's your reaction to this, Bill Leaders, first?
Well, I think it's unfortunate. I think, first of all, that we're now declaring who is the front runner, you know, what, 17 months before the election, based on how much money that they're raising, and that we know that ultimately the victor in this race is someone who's going to have to raise hundreds upon hundreds of millions of dollars. And that's what our politics have devolved into. I just think it's a sad commentary. And I also think that maybe having the most money isn't necessarily the key to having the inside track, that we may very well have a president who isn't the biggest money raiser, at least not at this point in time. I mean, ultimately, by the time someone is elected, if they don't raise hundreds of millions of dollars, they don't have a chance. But someone could still come from a dark horse candidacy position and cut against the early advantage that's perceived by the raising of these huge sums of money to both parties.
Kevin Hermany?
Well, if it were all about money, then Ross Perot would have become the president in the 1990s, and that didn't happen. It seems to me that, first of all, Bill, the election, the two main candidates are going to be known by next year at this time, which is less than a year from now, after all of the primaries are over, you know, the main primaries are over with by the middle of February.
So, yeah, but do you really think it's going to be either Hillary or Barack Obama simply because at this point in time they've raised, you know, such an astounding amount of money? Couldn't someone else come into that picture because maybe that's not the most important thing?
Well, if Al Gore gets the Peace Prize, he'll be able to contribute his $1 million to it himself.
Let's go. Let's talk a little bit on the Republican side. It was somewhat of a surprise, at least to some, that Mitt Romney was the Republican candidate who did raise the most money, then Rudy Giuliani, then John McCain, and a lot of people were very disappointed in the amount of money that John McCain, the supposed at one time front runner, raised. What do you make of this, Kevin Hermany?
Well, I'm going to get in trouble with one of my good friends who I think is listening this morning, and that is to suggest that there's a reason why John McCain is running third in the fundraising goal race, rather, and it's because he just hasn't gained traction among primary voters up to this point. And, you know, he's got a lot of work cut out for him in order to do that. Rudy Giuliani, of course, came to the actual candidate race later than did Mitt Romney. And so that may be the rationale behind the early fundraising success of the governor of Massachusetts.
Yeah, Bill Leaders?
I'd make the same point on the Republican side. I don't think that it's a given that the Republican nominee for president will be Mitt Romney or Rudy Giuliani or John McCain simply because they're the perceived front runners, you know, a year and a half before the election. Something else could happen.
Well, like Tommy Thompson could get in the race.
Tommy Thompson is in the race. He could very well emerge as a viable dark horse contender. I think Mike Huckabee, the governor of Arkansas, is also someone to watch as someone who has a real shot at the nomination. A lot of things can happen, and this horse race, this handicapping, the race based on how many millions of dollars the candidates are able to raise so early on, I just hope that's not an authoritative way to decide how we pick our presidents.
Well, outside of Arkansas, back in 1992, nobody nationally had ever heard of Bill Clinton until August of the year prior to the actual election.
Right.
So that would have been 1991. And here he was 15 months before that speaking at the Democratic National Convention, and half the people walked out because it went on forever.
Mm-hmm. And Carter, too, came out of nowhere.
Yeah. Mm. Kevin Hermany, why do you think former Wisconsin Governor Tommy Thompson is throwing his hat into the ring?
Well, like a lot of governors who have had a very successful run in their state, they believe that they can translate that into national success on the national stage. And he has a very long and impressive resume. Governor Thompson, of course, serving in the George W. Bush cabinet for many years as Health and Human Services Secretary. I think he's had an opportunity to meet a lot of people, to trumpet his welfare reform. There's a lot of there are a lot of people wondering, is this an effort to become so well nationally known that he would be a viable vice presidential candidate? It seems to me that at this point, Governor Thompson is in fact looking to the White House to serve as president rather than to try to position himself as best placed for a VP selection. And I think Tom Vilsack of Iowa has already relegated himself to that role. But Tommy Thompson is good to put a lot of great ideas out on the table. People have been very receptive to his message. He obviously hasn't gained the traction up to this point, but that's perhaps because he just came to the party.
Bill Leaders?
I have a joke about it. Play along with me, Joy.
Mm-hmm.
Knock, knock.
Who's there?
Tommy.
Tommy who?
That's what a lot of people are asking when they hear he's running for president.
Outside of Wisconsin, just like Arkansas.
We know him well and have learned to love him. I think he's a totally viable candidate for president. I think that he's actually would be a good nominee for his party. He's doing something very smart in announcing his candidacy as a reliable conservative, which is signaling to the party faithful that all three of these main contenders, Mitt Romney and Rudy Giuliani and John McCain, have been all over the map politically, at least within the broad tent of Republicanism, from being very liberal Republicans to being very conservative Republicans, depending on what the occasion suited. And Thompson has been Tommy Thompson. He's been someone who's always had a lot of ideas, always had a lot of energy, and he's always been a moderate Republican and has stuck to his guns through thick and thin. And I think
if in fact he's this moderate Republican, by which you just characterized him, how can he be painting himself accurately, in your words, as the true conservative in the race?
Because I think that conservatism doesn't have to mean that you're extreme hardcore right winger. It could mean that you're true to the conservative values of Republicanism that we once upheld. And I think being a moderate and being a conservative are not mutually exclusive things.
I agree with you. I wouldn't disagree at all. So tell me, what is one of your favorites going to do when she is asked by John Edwards at the debates in a couple of weeks as to whether or not Hillary's vote for the war was a mistake, after John Edwards announces that he believes it was a mistake?
I'm not sure who you mean. You mean Hillary? Is that who's one of my favorites?
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
No, God, no. I hope she doesn't get the nomination.
Well, that's a lot of progressives aren't big fans of Hillary Clinton.
No, I think that her early support for the war is a strike against her. I think she is, you know, something of an opportunist. I mean, she's not as terrible as the Republicans make her out to be. I mean, for some reason, people have just chosen to vilify her and just to direct a tremendous amount of pure hatred toward her. And I don't know how to interpret that other than there's some really nasty psychology that swirls around her. But
liberals and progressives never resort to personal partisan attacks.
Well, they do, but the fact that there's such a huge amount of vitriol that attaches to Hillary Clinton, and the fact that conservatives hate her with such boundless, bottomless passion, I just don't know where that comes from or how it's justified by anything this poor woman has ever done in her life.
We're going to talk about the politics of the state Supreme Court race and other state issues coming up after this short pause. We are reviewing the news of the week. This is our Friday Week in Review. Our guests today are Bill Leaders, news editor of Isthmus, Madison's Alternative Weekly. He's also president of the Wisconsin Freedom of Information Council and author of the book Cry Rape, now out in paperback, and Kevin Hermaning, former chair of the Marathon County Republican Party. He was a former hostage in Iran during the Iranian hostage crisis in the 70s, currently a financial planner in Wausau. 1-800-642-1234. We welcome your thoughts on the election this week, other news in state politics. We're going to talk about something that just broke yesterday. Georgia Thompson, a former state worker who lost her job and was actually sent to jail for the Travelgate affair, was released from jail yesterday. We'll talk about that coming up after this. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Stay tuned. Kathleen Dunn is with you after 9 o'clock, talking with award-winning investigative reporters James Steele and Donald Bartlett, talking about the latest government contractor that most people never heard of, the largest government contractor that most people never heard of. That's coming up after 9 o'clock. We're talking with Kevin Hermaning and Bill Leaders, our two guests for the Friday Week in Review. Moving on to state issues now, and let's talk about the results of the election on Tuesday, gentlemen, and the victory of Washington County Judge Annette Ziegler over Madison attorney Linda Clifford. This race had big spending and lots of advertising on television, lots of negative advertising. Washington County Judge Ziegler soundly defeated Clifford, 58% to 42%, I believe. What are your thoughts, Bill Leaders, on this? You've been following this race.
Yeah, I covered the race. I thought that they were both fairly impressive candidates, but that this race would devolve into a hideous mud fest, which is exactly what happened. And the amount of spending was not only unprecedented, I believe that it is precedent-setting. From now on, this is the way that Supreme Court races will be fought in Wisconsin, unless or until we reform the system. I think the amount of negativity was destructive to the Supreme Court. I think it was destructive to the individual candidates. I think they both did things that they shouldn't have. I draw a bit of a distinction between the negative campaigning that helped Ziegler get elected and some of the negative campaigning that Clifford and her supporters used. I do think in pointing out her ethical lapses in hearing cases in which she had an interest was a legitimate criticism, where I think that, you know, portraying her as a werewolf, portraying Clifford as a werewolf, as Ziegler's people tried to do, or to paint her as, you know, I'm not a judge, as though that's a prerequisite for serving on the court. It isn't. And continually hammering away at this being a prosecutor or being a judge who has handled criminal cases, as though that's the thing that Supreme Court justices do, is strictly enforce criminal law and keep our families safe. I think all of that was cheap on a level that denigrates Annette Ziegler, and she'll carry with her for the rest of her term, if not the rest of her life.
Well, Kevin Hermaning.
Well, even Paul Soglin, according to Bill's own editorial this week, I'm reading it online as we speak, called the Clifford campaign the worst campaign that's ever been run, quote. You know, I guess I would submit that campaigns are about winning the race as well as hoping to have their dignity after it's over. And the fact of the matter is there was an awful lot of money spent by both sides here, and the new Supreme Court Justice Ziegler now wants to bring about some change in the way campaigns are run and financed for the Supreme Court. I think that's a positive thing. She won't have that legislative ability, of course, because that's where this would have to take place, because it is constitutional in the state, so that's where it has to start and change, and the voters ultimately would have to make the decision on that. And I think the voters actually might make a decision to change it if the legislature could ever come to terms on it in two successive sessions. But I don't think that you can adequately and accurately make the case that pointing out issues on one hand and personalities on the other hand is fair or unfair. It's part of the campaign. Both angles are used by both candidates, and that certainly was used here. The accusation of ethical lapses, despite the fact that she didn't, in fact, have a financial interest in what is a publicly owned institution in West Bend, was not carried very far by the – I mean, it was totally distorted by the Clifford campaign and their supporters.
But that's not the standard.
The Supreme Court
rules don't say that you have to recuse yourself if you have a personal financial interest. They say if you have an apparent or perceived conflict.
Bill, she never even saw. I mean, we're not going to refight this race that was just decided overwhelmingly, by the way. It wasn't even close.
Yeah, it would have been overwhelming, too, even if she had not run negative ads. I mean, Linda Clifford had the money advantage. There were lots of groups that are interested in buying a Supreme Court justice that would side with corporations and against ordinary citizens, and they were prepared to throw millions of dollars into the race. She didn't need to stoop so low to win.
Nearly every newspaper in the state endorsed Linda Clifford for this race.
There's a reason for that.
Well, what's interesting is that in many of those columns, they talked about the fact, the editors talked about the fact that Ziegler was talking about how important it is that the person have judicial experience. And that was one of her big points about her campaign. We all know that. Mm-hmm. What's interesting is that in other races for the Supreme Court, many of these same editors, when the candidate running for the Supreme Court seat had judicial experience and the opponent didn't, who was the conservative or the perceived conservative, suddenly the judicial angle was important. And it's the lack of consistency that just drives some people crazy.
Speak of the lack of consistency, next year we'll have another Supreme Court race, and Justice Louis Butler will face re-election. And I guarantee you WMC and other conservative groups are going to throw millions of dollars into that race to defeat him. Justice Butler is a judge. He has judicial experience. They're going to come up with some other issue that they're going to run into the ground. It has nothing to do with the issue that they throw at these people. It has to do with their ability to pick Supreme Court justices by flooding the race with special interest money.
Wait a minute. You have no idea whether next year's challenger is going to have judicial experience or not, but you're right. That would be inconsistent if it was a non-judge running against Butler for this position, and they tried to make the case that, not being a judge isn't important.
My point is that Justice Butler in his own past has been a judge, both a circuit court judge and a municipal judge.
Yes,
but
he
they'll
was.
Come up with some other thing to paint him with and taint him with and throw at him, and they'll throw it with the same vigor that they threw the she's not a judge, which again
that's
is not a prerequisite.
That's because Justice Butler does not have a record that suggests that he is going to support on matters coming before him issues that would be favorable to business interests. That's the reason that they would be opposing him.
Yeah, I agree that's the reason.
They're not going to choose any other reason, and that's a legitimate reason to get involved in a race.
But let's agree on this. What we really ought to do with regard to WMC's involvement in judicial politics in Wisconsin, we ought to stop WMC from lying to the voters.
Back in 2005, what you really want to do is have my taxpayer dollars elect your people to the government positions.
I support full public financing. I think it's a good idea. I talk to people in North Carolina, where it's been done and where it's worked out wonderfully. There are other things we could do that could erode, that could cut against what Supreme Court races are becoming. But WMC in 2005, there were some decisions that affected liability law, and they just threw a fit about it. They talked about how there would be thousands of frivolous lawsuits that would destroy jobs in Wisconsin, that there'd be a floodgate of litigation. They didn't say that these were things that might happen. They said that these were things that would happen. Guess what? These are things that didn't happen. And yet they were able to say that. They were able to use it as a political score point and not be held accountable when, 2 years later, they can't point to any of the consequences that they said would occur.
I have Zach in Green Bay who wants to get in on this. Hi, Zach. You're on the air.
Good morning. My comments relate to the Annette Ziegler victory and her margin of victory. And I dare say I am aware of nobody who would be interested in going in front of a judge in which that judge would have at least $50,000 in ownership or financial interest in their opponent and not be aware of that. And that is, in fact, the case with Annette Ziegler 22 times, which he does not deny. The significant thing that I want to say is that, at least in northeastern Wisconsin, the television news stations ignored and sat on this story for weeks. And they waited until the last minute, and then it may have come out in the context of, oh, what a dirty campaign this was. To me, this was censorship by omission by the management of the television stations, and had a massive effect on the outcome of the race.
I'm wondering, Bill Leaders, if you want to blame the media for this or the voters.
Well, I think the media did a good job in covering the conflict issue. I don't think that Annette Ziegler has been honest the way that she's framed it. She said, I have no personal gain from these cases. Most of these cases, it didn't matter that, my husband owned stock in the company I represent. But there were particular cases which the media wrote about. And even one is too many, where she presided over a case involving this bank. She ruled in the bank's favor. The people who were defendants against the bank's action felt that she was not fair in how she handled the case. They felt that they wished they had known that she had some personal connection to one of the parties in the case and would have asked for a recusal had they known that. That's a matter of record that people felt that way. And for a judge not to have informed them of her personal involvement in conflict in the case is a violation of the rules, at least as far as I understand them. And it doesn't reflect well on her.
Well, I guess we're going to know, aren't we, after the judicial panel takes this up?
I don't know. And, my feeling is that Judicial Commission, like the Office of Lawyer Regulation, serve primarily to protect lawyers and judges. They are not meaningful watchdogs. But, there may be some minor consequence, some scolding that she will receive for what she did.
Yeah. I think anybody who's running as an attorney from Madison for any position statewide is going to have a problem being elected to a Supreme Court position.
Yeah, we almost out of time, so I need to move on to this at least one more issue here. This Georgia Thompson's lawyer says the former state worker wrongly lost her job, her home, her liberty, and her good name, all as the result of a conviction that a federal appeals court vacated yesterday for lack of evidence. Governor Jim Doyle says Georgia Thompson will be entitled to her job back as a purchasing supervisor with the Department of Administration if she wants it, as well as legal fees and back pay. Georgia Thompson was convicted of steering a travel contract to a company whose chief executive donated to Doyle's reelection campaign. But again, that conviction has been overturned. This is pretty stunning, isn't it, Bill?
It's
Leaders?
Astounding. I mean, this is the equivalent of a Perry Mason moment, you know, where he's got someone on the stand and he asks a bunch of questions. Suddenly they confess, I did the crime. It was me. And the defendant is released, you know, on the spot. I mean, the appellate court heard 28 or 26 minutes of arguments before, of oral arguments, before it threw out the case and freed Georgia. It didn't order a new trial. It just threw out the conviction and ordered her release. This is indicative of an astounding lack of evidence at the core of the case. It was a bad prosecution to begin with. I will make one other point about this, and Kevin would probably approve. I really want to take issue with Governor Thompson's after-the-fact comments in which he's bashing the media for sensationalizing
Governor Doyle's.
Oh, I'm sorry, Governor Doyle. I misspoke. Thompson. Georgia Thompson is
confusing
me. Sounds
conveniently, though, doesn't it, Bill?
We got a Thompson and a Doyle
right,
in here. You know, Doyle's is saying that this was a terrible injustice, that this was an innocent woman who was just doing her job. I mean, when it mattered, all that Governor Doyle cared about was protecting his own political hide. He didn't say any of those things in support of his employee. Back then, he was saying that, you know, people who have ethical lapses in his administration deserve to be rooted out. He didn't stand up for her when it mattered. And for him to come out after the fact and blame the media is totally disingenuous. If he had said that she was an innocent woman who was the victim of a terrible injustice, trust me, the media would have paid attention. It would have given him license to say that far and wide.
Kevin Hermaning, your thoughts on this whole case here?
Well, it is interesting. I mean, that's what the newspaper is reporting, that Governor Doyle has said that she clearly was an innocent woman in prison for more than 4 months just for doing her job. What is interesting, I think, I went and did some research on this morning. Two of the three justices that heard the case yesterday, or the limited arguments, if you will, were appointed by Republicans. Frank Easterbrook, who is the chief judge there, was appointed by Reagan back in 1985. And President Nixon, way back in 1974, appointed Senior Circuit Judge William Bauer. Diane Wood is the one appointed by Clinton, who was quoted in the newspaper piece columns today or articles today. But clearly, this is a case that didn't have any legs, and it only had political purposes back in 2004. Yes, 2006.
We're going to have to leave it there because we're at the end of the hour, but we'll hope to have both of you back to talk more about the news of the week during our Week in Review. Kevin Hermaning, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you.
And Bill Leaders, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Bill Leaders, news editor of ISMIS, Madison's Alternative Weekly, president of the Wisconsin Freedom of Information Council, and author of Cry Rape. Kevin Hermaning, former chair of the Marathon County Republican Party, a former hostage in Iran in the 70s, currently a financial planner in Wausau. Thanks to them both. Thanks to Leo Duran for producing this hour. Thank you for listening. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.